This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, and today for Terry Gross. Our guest today, actor Matthew McFadyen, is one of the ensemble cast members of the hit HBO series Succession. He plays an aspiring business executive from the Midwest so well that American audiences might be surprised to learn that he's British, with a long list of credits in British stage, TV, and film. Many will recall him playing the dashing Mr. Darcy in director Joe Wright's 2005 version of Pride and Prejudice. He starred in a series which aired on AMC called Quiz, based on the true story of a man convicted of cheating on the original British version of the TV show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And he stars in the forthcoming film Operation Mincemeat, about a secret effort in World War II to keep the Nazi invasion of Sicily hidden from the German army. In Succession, McFadyen plays Tom Wamsgans, who's dating and then marries Siobhan Roy, who's one of three siblings competing for control of their aging father's media empire when he retires or dies. Tom is a player in the corporate intrigue, but as an in-law, he's never quite on an even footing with Siobhan and her brothers. In this scene from the first episode, the family's celebrating the patriarch's birthday with a picnic and a softball game, and Tom, hoping to ingratiate himself with the old man, approaches and gives him a case bearing an expensive watch, a Patek Philippe, and it doesn't exactly go over. The patriarch, Logan Roy, is played by Brian Cox. Matthew McFadyen as Tom speaks first.
Hey, so I just wanted to give this to you in person just to say, happy birthday. So, It's a Patek Philippe, so.
Yeah, it says Patek Philippe.
Yeah. It's incredibly accurate. Every time you look at it, it tells you exactly how rich you are.
That's very funny. Did you rehearse that?
No. Yes. But.
Okay.
Okay, let's play ball.
Oh boy, painful. Well, Matthew McFadyen, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
That scene is from the beginning of the series. And you know, I'd never heard of a Patek Philippe watch. And I went online and I discovered that there's one that's a pre-owned one of them available for $120,000. And poor Tom offers this gift, doesn't even get a simple thank you. Boy, this kind of lets us know it's going to be rough for Tom and this family, doesn't it?
I think it does, yeah. That was my first inkling into what might lie await in store for Tom if we went. And also, when we were shooting the pilot, we didn't know it was going to go on. So I thought, you know, there were these sort of markers about what might happen to him. But that was a fun scene to play with Brian. I'm a big watch nerd, so I know all about those Pateks and all those sort of crazy watches and how much they cost. And
yeah. How did you get the part on Succession?
It came from Jesse. I think it was a pilot. It was pilot season. I just finished a job called Ripper Street, which had gone for five seasons in shooting in Dublin. It was a Victorian detective show, which was great fun. And so I was sort of at a loose end a little bit. And I'd done a Nutcracker for Disney, and I was sort of floating about and wondering what to do. And I wanted to do something in the States, maybe, and maybe play an American. I hadn't done that before, except on stage at the Royal Court about 10 years previously. And then this pilot came through, and I knew of Jesse, and I loved Peep Show and Fresh Meat and various things like that. And I knew how, you know, knew his writing from the thick of it and other things like that. So it was such a thing to read. It was just fantastically acid and funny and interesting, you know, especially it was election year and the Trumps were sort of hoving into view a little bit. And
right. You mentioned Jesse. That's Jesse Armstrong, the creator and showrunner of the show. One of the things that people say about Succession, especially those who say they don't like it, is that none of the characters are likable. You know, actors like to feel invested in their characters. Do you agree that these people aren't likable?
They're not especially likable, but they're not monsters. So they're not in, you know, there's always some sort of sympathy there. And I think, you know, they're humans. And so there's always a sliver of something, you know. And I think the interesting thing about all those characters is it's those perennial themes of power and love and family. It's a family dynamic, you know, and it's the sort of absence of love from the father figure, Logan Roy, who's the sort of center of it all. and around whom everyone sort of orbits. And so you sort of, I feel a great deal of sympathy for them in a strange way, because they don't, often it seems to me, they don't have an awful lot of confidence because they don't feel terribly loved by their father or their mother, indeed.
I mean, Brian Cox does this so well. There's one of the little things he does is when someone will approach him and say something important, and he'll listen and just say, mm-hmm, just this utterly noncommittal, lest I know this is, you think this is important, I have power, and you're not getting an ounce of affirmation from me.
That's right.
Puts you really off balance, I think, all the time.
That's right. You're always slightly off balance. They'd never really have any real confidence.
Well, your character, Tom, has two really important relationships that run throughout the series. One of them, of course, is with his wife, Siobhan, known as Shiv. They actually get married in season one. And what a wedding that is. Tom adores her and gets a lot of pain in return, right? And Shiv, on occasion, tells him she doesn't love him, even though she knows he loves her. She floats the idea of an open marriage. Here's a scene on in the series where you, as Tom, are at the beach with Shiv, and you're kind of getting fed up with this, and you push back, and we're kind of catching the scene in the middle. Siobhan is played by Sarah Snook, and you, as Tom, speak first.
You told me you wanted an open relationship on our wedding night.
So you've been stewing on that?
Well, yes. I have been stewing, actually. I'm not a hippie, Shiv. I don't want to do threesomes.
Okay.
Our wedding night? Bang! Shanghaied into a open borders free trade deal.
It was just an idea.
Well, that's a biggie just to throw in at the altar. I don't think it was cool what you did. I think a lot of the time, if I think about it, I think a lot of the time, I'm really pretty unhappy.
What are you saying?
I don't know. I love you, I do. I just, I wonder if the sad I'd be without you would be less than the sad I get from being with you.
That's our guest, Matthew McFadyen, and Sarah Snook in a scene from Succession. So does Tom really love Siobhan, or does he love, I don't know, everything that comes with it, you know, access to power and wealth?
I think both. I think he does love her, I don't think he knows. You know, it's always that thing. You start asking those questions, but really, I don't think they have any hard and fast answers. He would say that he does, and he certainly loves all the reflected glory and power of being a Roy. You know, but I don't know. It's interesting. Sarah and I are often asked, you know, why are they together? And we talked to Jesse a little bit, and we sort of thought maybe there's a nice idea that perhaps Tom came along when Shiv was in a very low place and, you know, they got together and he's sort of safe and he's not a threat, and so she'll never leave him. She'll probably have lots of affairs and one-night stands, and, you know, but he's never going to let her down.
Right, so someone that she can count on, whether or not she is fully invested.
Exactly, and he's happy to sort of suck that up and, you know, shimmy his way up the greasy pole in Waystar and all the rest of it.
You know, one thing that people who haven't seen the series may not be aware of, but people who have watched it know, is the way extravagant wealth is displayed. I mean, I'm not somebody particularly interested in, you know, rich people's houses and the like, but I got to say, I mean, when I see these Italian villas and this yacht at the end of season two, that's just, it's wow.
I know. The yacht, Dave, that's, well, the weird thing is how quickly you get used to it. That's the really frightening thing, because we all got on this yacht and this has, you know, our jaws were swinging. But, you know, like anything, after a day or two, it's totally normal. Like, yeah, I'm going to work on the yacht. Speedboat to the yacht. We do a day's work and go back to the hotel. And it becomes very sort of, oh, yeah. That's the really alarming thing.
When I think about this relationship, it made me think that, you know, when you're around this and you say, this is pretty cool, and maybe you begin to think, you know, I really wouldn't want to lose this. And if that means I've got to take some crap or a relationship that's less than satisfying or maybe elbow somebody out of the way, man, look at what I get.
Yeah, I'd rather sort of, yeah, I'll take all the crap from Logan Roy as a, you know, rather than take it from somebody else, you know, and be close to the center of power. And it's interesting.
You know, the other big relationship, ongoing relationship you have besides your wife, Siobhan, is the younger member of the Waystar crew, Cousin Greg, who is a terrific character. He's sort of, I guess you might say, endowed with more ambition than brains. And you, as Tom, kind of take him under your wing and you kind of mock him and torture him at times. And it's hard not to see Tom as a guy who is dumped on by others in the family, including his wife, and that he just, you know, sends some of that abuse down to Greg because he can. Yeah?
Yeah, I think that's it's certainly a case of kicking the cat with old Gregory. But also there's a, again, it's a, there's just so much there. Well, so much that we, Nick and I, have sort of brought to it, and then the writers. There is a circularity with the acting and the writing, and I think that long-form TV like this is wonderful in that it sort of becomes, if it's working well, it becomes symbiotic with the actors and the writers because they see something that we do. You know, we'll do something which is given to us from this magic writing, and then they'll see something else, and then that'll feed back into the script, and on it goes. You know, there's a, I think the Roman Jerry relationship started like that. They saw a little look that they gave each other and then developed into.
Right, one of the odder relationships of the story.
But sort of totally, I totally believe it. You know, it's, and I think there's a lot of Greg and Tom with that as well. You know, the going into the Nero and Sporus thing. I think Tom really likes Greg and really needs him and, you know, it has a sort of, you know, he's quite open with him and quite honest, and it's fascinating.
Yeah, there's some great scenes. You mentioned Nick. That's Nicholas Braun, who plays Cousin Greg, who's a younger guy. And I got to say, I mean, what he does in this role, it's pretty remarkable because he's got to appear kind of sort of naive and foolish, yet with this sort of, you know, vein of ambition that really comes up. It's kind of subtle. I think he does terrific stuff with it.
I think you're dead right. I think there's, it's other, because otherwise it's just sort of goofy and daft, and he really, there's so much there, and he's always watching and always paying attention, Cousin Greg, and he's, you know, he's not a pushover. I mean, and he's not without vanity either. It's really, none of them are, you know, they're not, it's really interesting. It's nuanced, and it's not black and white. It's, yeah, it's great.
Well, I want to play a scene of you and Cousin Greg, and this is in the last episode of the season, and it's after the moment when you, as Tom, have decided to make your move against Siobhan, his wife, and the other her brothers, the other Roy siblings, and effectively switch sides. And in this scene, he comes to Greg and invites him to join him. There's some noise here. This is at an outdoor wedding reception. To just ask Greg if he wants to come along with him in this enterprise. One note for the dialogue. Earlier in the series, when the company was in trouble, Greg had to testify before Congress and kind of made a fool of himself. I mention that because Tom is going to bring this up as he has the conversation with Greg. So this is Cousin Greg, played by Nicholas Braun, and we will hear our guest, Matthew McFadyen, and his Tom speak first.
Greg, listen. What's up?
So, things may be in motion.
As in, is anyone going to jail?
No. No. So, do you want to come with me? Sporus?
Can I ask for a little more information?
No. Don't think so. I might need you as my attack dog.
Right.
Like a Greg Weiler.
Tom's attack dog. Nice. I mean, I have Bright Star Buffalo in my hip pocket. I'm kind of a big deal, so.
You f***ed yourself before Congress, Greg.
That's your opinion.
I don't recall, Your Honor. I don't recall your joke, man.
Who has ever looked after you and this family, huh?
All right. Well, in terms of where I could be getting to if I were to come with?
You could be heading away from the endless middle and towards the bottom of the top.
The bottom of the top? And could I get my own,
your own Greg?
Yeah.
You could have 20.
Heavy intrigue in the HBO series Succession. That's our guest, Matthew McFadyen, and cousin Greg, played by Nicholas Braun. It's so funny to hear him, you know, I'm kind of a big deal.
I love it. He's so pleased with himself. And he's so delighted at the prospect of moving away from the endless middle and towards the bottom of the top.
Bottom of the top.
It's just beautiful writing. It's so great. Not only is it wonderful acting with Nick and everybody, and they're all sensational actors, but when you've got writing like that, it's not easy peasy, but it's just a joy because you just sort of trust it to do the work, and it's just great.
I completely agree. The writing is so much fun, and in fact that's what I was going to note, is how much fun it must be to say things like, you screwed up in front of Congress, blah, 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 you're a joke.
The difficulty is not breaking up. Nick and I have real, I've said this a lot. It's not a secret that we struggle with corpsing, as we say in the UK, which is just, breaking up irretrievably and everyone getting annoyed with us and them having to reset. And but it's hard when the dialogue's so funny. And
right. Nowhere in my life do I ever hear people insult each other the way they routinely do in this. But it must be so much fun because they're so sharp and clever.
It's great. It's extremely satisfying because, like anything, it's like you sort of think, well, I'm getting all this out of my system. It's sort of brilliant. You can just think, well, I am this incredibly witty person. Tom, it doesn't always work with Tom, but sometimes it's very satisfying, especially with Greg.
There is a scene where you go in. It's actually when the company has been under the cloud of a federal investigation, and it looked like you, Tom, and Greg would be the two people most likely to go to prison. And you learn that it's probably not going to happen. It's, there's just going to be a fine. And you go into Greg's office. Well, you want to say what happens? Tell us about this.
So the stage directions are Tom goes in. Well, there's a small scene. I say hi. He says, hi, Tom. And I say, scooch over a bit. And I sort of sit with him, or stand by his desk. And then it says, Tom lifts up Greg's desk and smashes his office to bits. And that was it. So the rest was sort of up to us. So it was just, it was lovely. And we sort of, Loreen Scafaria, the director, and me and Nick and our operators, we sort of worked out a rough bit of blocking and then we went for it. I think we did maybe 5 or 6 takes.
They had to put the office back together 5 times.
They put it back together so that I would sort of say, I'll kick this bin and I'll maybe throw this bit of fruit and I'll hit that, I'll do this. And they were like, okay, fine, fine. And they put it all back.
I have to look at that one again in preparing for our conversation. And after you throw things around and turn over the desk, you hop on top of a file cabinet and do this Tarzan-like yell. It's so cool.
I actually beat my chest. I think that was a possible suggestion, like maybe Tom beats his chest, but I don't. Yeah, I can't remember. It came out of somewhere. Or it might have been a suggestion from Loreen, our director. I can't remember.
Yeah, the I'm not going to jail move.
I'm Tarzan. I'm free.
I read that you don't get the script of the episodes until the day before you shoot or the day before you do a table read. Is that right?
They come very late. And we're used to it now, but I think it was a little alarming. I think, Brian would get vexated because he had more lines to learn. I was never that bothered because, there'd be unless I had an awful lot to say, but I like the freshness of it. I like the sort of on the hoof quality that it brings. But yeah, they come very late. Sometimes, an hour before the table read.
Are you, this is a huge hit show and I know you live in London, but when you're in the States, do you get recognized on the street a lot now?
When we were shooting the last season, yes, more than usual. I think only as a function of the show reaching a wider audience and, getting a bit of recognition and all that sort of stuff. So there's,
What do people say to you?
Secession! Or they go, Wamsgans! Or very occasionally they go, hey, Greg! And I smile and wave and walk on. But it's all good. It's all overwhelmingly positive.
Do they demand to know when the next season's starting?
Yeah, that's the other thing. They, so often people would stop and I'd get ready for a selfie or something, and they wouldn't be interested in that. They just want to know when it's coming on again. And then they'd walk away, you know, sort of brusque New Yorkers.
All right, let's take another break here. Let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Matthew McFadyen. He plays Tom Wamsgans in the HBO series Succession. He'll be back to talk more after this short break. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. Our guest is actor Matthew McFadyen, who plays Tom Wamsgans in the HBO series Succession. He played Mr. Darcy in the 2005 film Pride and Prejudice. And he stars in the forthcoming movie Operation Mincemeat. Let's talk just a little bit about your past. You were born in England, in a coastal city, I think, right? And your dad was in the oil business. You moved around a lot, right?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, he was an engineer in the oil business, and we lived on the East Coast, east of England, in a county called Norfolk for a bit, and then we went to London, and then we went to Scotland, and then came back to another part of the north of England called Lincolnshire, and then we went to the Far East, by which time I was about 10, and I went from Jakarta in Indonesia to a boarding school back in the Midlands in England.
Your mom was trained as an actress and taught drama, I gather. What got you interested in the business and doing it?
I don't know. I think, my mom trained as a teacher at a sort of like a drama teacher. And my grandfather was an engineer. Her father was an engineer. But his hobby and his real interest was the theater and doing amateur dramatics. And, you know, he would take shows on tour with Amdram, and they would go to Europe, and so that was his real passion. And
he would go as a performer, or
no? He would direct and produce these plays, and they would go. You know, they would go to other Amdram festivals in, you know, in France and Italy and places like that. Yeah, in the '60s and seventies. So that was his sort of hobby, really. And his father was a Welsh chapel minister. And so there was a sort of tradition of Eisteddfod's, you know, the Welsh speaking festivals and poetry, you know, so there was, I don't know, I mean, that had no connection, but I guess that sort of, even though it was a family of teachers and engineers and, you know, there wasn't nobody who'd sort of done it professionally in my family.
The spoken word was all around you, yeah.
Yeah, we were encouraged to sort of be in the school play. And then I you know, like all the, I guess you find something that you really like and that you're good at, or people think you're good at, and so it just goes from there. So I was always trying to be in the school play. And
well, you were accepted at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London at the age of 17, right? And then at the age of 21, joined the Cheek by Jowl Touring Company, which I gather was a pretty serious gig for a young man of your age.
That was great. That was a red letter day. I think because then this was 95, I think, and then the most, I never imagined I would do TV, let alone film. And the most exciting prospect, I think, for our year at drama school, or that, you know, that generation, was, I think, a really exciting idea was to go with the Royal Shakespeare Company or the National and do a tour, or one of these companies like Cheek by Jowl or Theatre de Complicité. And that was like the dream. And I managed to land this tour with Cheek by Jowl in a production of The Duchess of Malfi. And it was a world tour. We went everywhere in 10 months. We went to BAM in New York and Italy and Colombia and Australia, and it was nuts.
What did you learn about the craft in those early years?
I learned that I wasn't very good in my first play. Yeah, I was really bad. I really struggled. It was quite a shock, actually. But looking back, I guess it was quite a good thing, because it was my first job, and it was quite scary and quite lonely at times. There were lovely people in the company, but it was a sort of difficult part. It was Antonio in The Duchess of Malfi, which is quite a, it's quite a hard play, because there's not a lot of light and love in the play. But I didn't know how to make Antonio interesting, and I just wasn't very good. And the reviewers didn't think I was very good either. So, I think I had enough confidence to know it wasn't, you know, I needed a different vehicle. But it was really good. It was a real privilege to go and play in these, you know, we'd play in a different theatre every week and in a different country, and, you know, we'd meet other theatre companies. And it was, yeah, I mean, I was 20 doing this play at BAM in 1996, and it was, I'd never been to New York before, and amazing.
Well, you obviously brought something to the game because you've got a long, long list of work in British television and film and stage. And I got to bring this up. You know, I think is your film, your appearance in Pride and Prejudice. You know, I'm sure Siobhan and Succession would not take you so for granted if she'd seen you as the dreamboat Mr. Darcy in the Joe Wright production.
There's a lot. Yeah, there's a, it, Tom Wormsgans is a long way from Mr. Darcy.
you have this kind of, you know, you're tall and this high-collared gentleman's, you know, dress with the shaggy haircut. He's sort of an aloof, distant character, but there's really a lot more to him. Was it at all intimidating to play this kind of literary figure, which had been done by, a lot before, you know, by Colin Firth a few years before?
Yeah, it had. It was quite intimidating. It was, really. I tried not to, you know, I think inevitably you worry about getting it right. And I didn't feel I was dishy enough and sort of brooding enough. And, you know, in your mind's eye as an actor, you always want to be a little more this or a little more that. And my confidence wasn't great. But again, it was a brilliant adaptation, and, you know, Joe was great, and Kira was great, and the actors were, you know, it was a lovely thing to be a part of.
Yeah, it's Joe Wright, the director, and Kira Knightley, who was Elizabeth Bennet. So how did you find Dishy?
I don't know. I just hope for the best. I don't know. I sort of decided that he was a bit sort of like a tortured adolescent, Mr. Darcy, which in a way he was. He was, you know, he's grieving his parents. He's inherited this vast estate and responsibility, and yeah, he's sort of all conflicted and torn up. And so I thought, that'll be my way into him.
Well, you know, there's an internet meme that developed out of a small quiet moment in that film early on. I mean, I'm sure you know this. I mean, where you're helping
the hand,
Elizabeth Bennet, played by Keira Knightley, out of a carriage. You don't really know each other well, and she didn't particularly like you, but you take her hand to help her into the carriage. And as you're walking away, the camera catches you flexing the hand, you know, having had this incidental contact. She's looking back at you. There's a lot of internet stuff on this. I saw one. I learned this from our digital producer, Molly C.V. Nesper, who says this has gotten a lot of attention. There was one TikTok of a woman who got a tattoo of your hand and Keira Knightley's.
You're kidding.
On her shoulder. Yeah.
He's so buttoned up, he can't show a thing.
Was this scripted? Was this planned all along, that shot?
No, it's credit to Joe, because he doesn't miss a trick, and he's so alive to things, and he saw me do it in a take, in a rehearsal or a take, and I remember him just going, "Get that." So they just did an extra shot on the hand. You know, they were already on a sort of tracking shot. So, yeah.
We need to take a break here. Let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Matthew McFadyen. He plays Tom Wormsgans in the HBO series Succession, and we will continue this conversation in just a moment. This is Fresh Air. I wanted to talk about a TV series that Americans may have seen you in. It was called Quiz. I think it was produced by Independent Television in Great Britain and shown on AMC. Is that right?
That's right, yeah.
And it's about the true story of a man in England who happened to be a major in the British Army, Charles Ingram, who appeared on the show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, which originated in the UK. And he wins £1 million and then is accused with his wife, Diana, and eventually convicted of cheating to get the answers. So this is a real story. It was based on a play by James Graham, right? You want to explain how the cheating occurred, how the couple supposedly – how Charles knew what answers to give?
Well, I'm not sure that I can, because he was convicted of cheating through a sort of system of, they alleged that he had an accomplice in the audience who was coughing at the right answers, you know, when they sort of read out, and that was how he did it. But he denies this. They both deny this to this day. But the jury found them guilty, and they were given a suspended sentence.
Right, and I think they have an active appeal, I believe.
I think they might do. Yeah, they were quite pleased when the show came out, because it meant they could sort of get their case back, you know, back into the public eye and get it going again. But a fascinating story.
I've got a scene we should hear. This is a scene where you, as Charles Ingram, is on the show, who wants to be a millionaire, and you're taking a question. You've advanced to the level where £500,000 is at stake. And here you're being asked a question by the host, Chris Tarrant, who's actually played by Michael Sheen. So he asked the question, and it takes a while for you to answer. Let's listen.
For £500,000. Baron Haussmann is best known for the planning of which city? Rome, Paris, Berlin, Athens.
I think it's Berlin. Yeah, Berlin, I mean, Haussmann, you know, seems like a German name rather than an Italian name or a Parisian name or an Athens name. Rome, Paris. Yeah, do you know, I'm gonna rethink it because I don't think it's Athens, and I'm pretty sure it's not Rome, and I would have thought it was Berlin, but there's a chance it could be Paris. Yeah, I think it's Paris. I'm going to play.
Hang on, wait, where are we?
No, Paris. Paris, final answer.
Final answer.
Final answer.
Thought it was Berlin. Berlin, Berlin, Berlin. Change your mind to Paris. That's brought you £500,000.
Oh, the excitement, the tension. Oh, that is our guest, Matthew McFadyen. In the series quiz, also in that scene was Michael Sheen.
That was such fun to do because they built this studio, you know, built this amazing set. It was exactly as it was. So it's not hard to, my heart was banging away because it's, you know, you're there. It's not a leap of the imagination to think, oh my God, I'm actually doing it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Michael Sheen playing Chris Tarrant there, it just hands it up beautifully. I mean, it's so much fun.
Brilliant. Yeah.
And what happens, of course, we hear you saying each possible answer, and then if you listen carefully, there is a cough a couple of times when Paris.
There's a cough, and there's a sort of confirmatory cough.
Right.
The second time he says Paris, yeah.
Right. And what's interesting about, I think, I gather the play, and certainly the series, is that it doesn't really quite take a position on whether they cheated or not, this couple. And I must pose a challenge as an actor. I mean, are you a clever thief, you know, disguising your crime, or are you someone unjustly accused?
I'm still sort of agnostic about it. I really don't know. And Sean Clifford, who played Diana, and I would sort of meet in the morning in the makeup bus and go, those guilty bastards, they did it. And then the next morning we'd say, no, I don't think they did. I think they're the victims of a stitch up, and we would change our minds constantly. And at the end, we sort of settled into sort of happy ambivalence. And we would, Stephen Frears, the director, would sort of say, well, let's, you know, on this take, maybe let's dial up the culpability a wee bit, and then maybe let's sort of be a bit more innocent on the next one. And so he had options in the cutting room, I suppose. But yeah, I don't know, is the answer.
Right, you don't know. I mean, one of the things that comes out, which has come out subsequently, is that while there were coughs associated with correct answers, there was a total of 192 coughs over the course of the broadcast. So the accusation is that the prosecution...
Exactly. And the episode in question was never broadcast, of course, because it was ITV's. And once they realized something was up, and so the ITV, and they admit this, they doctored the, you know, that episode to show the jury. You know, there were hundreds of coughs all over it, but I think they sort of pulled up the volume.
It was a really celebrated case, and I gather that the couple got coughed at by people on the street as a way of mocking them.
Yeah, they had a dreadful, torrid, horrible time afterwards.
You know, one more thing. During the pandemic, when, you know, many of us were, you know, resigned to our homes, you live in London with your wife, Keely Hawes, who's an actress, and you have teenage kids, right? You did kind of a home cooking show for television. Do I have this right?
Yeah, we did something called Come Dine With Me, which is, I don't know if they have it in the States. It's we all did a meal on consecutive nights and then judged it. And there was a small cash prize.
You and your wife and each of your kids kind of competed to cook the best meal?
Yeah. And they were very competitive. It got quite ugly towards the end. and I lost. And I think I'm a really good cook. But we had a nice time in the pandemic. It was good. Lockdown was all right. I think we realized that we all got on. And the weather was good. And, you know, I think it was a sort of different experience. It was very interesting going to New York, actually, after, you know, to start work on Succession, because there was a totally different feeling in New York. I think just the geography of the city and what had happened, you know, at the height of it, it was just a lot more frightening.
Well, Matthew McFadyen, it's been fun. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, you're most welcome. Real pleasure. Thanks, Dave.
Matthew McFadyen plays Tom Wamsgans in the HBO series Succession. Succession has been renewed for a fourth season. Coming up, we remember Vietnamese Buddhist monk and peace activist Thich Nhat Hanh, who died last Saturday. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Future. What are the best workout programs? The ones that are custom-built just for you. Future is the new workout experience that pairs you one-on-one with your own fitness coach. Your coach will map out a plan based on your goals, with workouts delivered to your phone each week. Future, your Apple Watch, and the app all pair seamlessly, so you can communicate with your coach, track your progress, and celebrate your achievements. Get started with 50% off your first 3 months at tryfuture.com/NPR.
Thich Nhat Hanh, a Vietnamese Buddhist monk who was exiled from his country for opposing the war in 1966, died Saturday at his home in Hue, Vietnam. He was 95. Thich became one of the world's most influential Zen masters, campaigning for peace and urging the practice of mindfulness meditation. While still living in Vietnam, he started a movement called Engaged Buddhism, which combined meditation and anti-war work. He established dozens of monasteries around the world, the largest in southwest France. Terry spoke to Thich Nhat Hanh in 1997 and asked him about the work they did with Engaged Buddhism.
What were some of the things that you did during wartime in Vietnam to help other people?
We trained young monks and young people so that they become social and peace workers coming to the area where they are victims of war, to care for the wounded, to resettle the refugees, and to set up new places for these people to live, to build school for children, to build a health center. We did all sort of things, but the essential is that we did that as practitioners and not just social workers alone.
You know, the image of mindful breathing and so on is an image of stillness. And in wartime, there's often the need to flee as fast as you possibly can. Were those two things compatible? Were you able to practice stillness and the ability to run for your life when you needed to?
That is a matter of training. The practice is the practice of mindfulness. Mindfulness is the energy that helps you to be aware of what is going on. Like when you walk, you can walk mindfully. When you drink, you can drink mindfully. And when you run, you can run mindfully. Running mindfully is quite different from just running. And that is why mindfulness does not mean that you have to slow down. You do things very slowly. The essential is that you are mindful while you do things, whether you do it slowly or quickly. So when you try to help refugees, and if they get lost in their panics and the fear, and if you also get lost in the panic and the fear, you cannot help them a lot. Therefore, you have to maintain some kind of calm in order to be a real helper. That is why the practice is so important while you are a social activist.
During the war in Vietnam, when the Americans were in Vietnam, several Buddhist monks burned themselves in protest. I mean, they set themselves on fire and committed suicide to protest the war. As a Buddhist monk yourself, I'm wondering what you thought of that as a way of calling attention to the war.
I think before burning themselves, they had tried other ways, trying to express their desire that the war be stopped, that people sit down, negotiating to end the war. But because of the fact that the warring parties did not listen to them, and their voices are lost in the sounds of bombs and mortars, that is why they had to take that kind of drastic measure. And some people say that that is an act of suicide, but it's not really so, because when you are motivated by the desire to end the war and to help the people to suffer suffering, that is really the energy of compassion that motivates you to do it. And burning oneself alive is just one means in order to make our aspiration understood to the world.
Did you know those monks?
I knew quite a few of them, like the monk Thich Quảng Đức, who was the first who immolated herself. I stayed with him in his monastery for many months, and we knew each other quite well. And I knew that he was a very kind, good-hearted monk.
Your trip to America to protest the American presence in Vietnam resulted in your exile from South Vietnam. Were you actually given an official reason for being exiled?
Well, I did not intend to come and to stay for a long time in the West. In fact, I was invited to deliver a series of talks and took the opportunity to speak about the war, the version that was not heard by people outside of Vietnam, because the Buddhists in Vietnam represent the majority who do not side themselves with any warring parties. And what we wanted really is not a victory, but the end of the war. So what I told people over here at that time did not please any warring party in Vietnam. That is why I was not allowed to go home. And it was very hard for me, because all my friends were there, all my work was there. But because I was already practicing as a monk, mindfulness practice told me that you have to live each day of your life properly. So my practice at that time was to realize that the wonders of life were already there. And while trying to do something to end the war in Vietnam, I could continue my life and getting in touch with this wonderful, refreshing and healing inside of me and outside of me. So in the process of working to end the war, I also practiced the, nourishing myself, making friends, realizing that life over here is also wonderful, not just in Vietnam, and the dream stopped to come back.
When you teach mindfulness, you're in part teaching breathing, and breathing is really central to meditation. Why is breathing so important?
In our daily life, very often our body is there, but our mind is not there. Our mind can get lost in the past, in the future, in our worries and anxieties and fear. And you are not really there, alive. Our breath is something like a bridge linking body and mind. And as soon as you go back to your breath and breathing in and out mindfully, you bring your body and mind together. And there you are again, fully alive. And if you are really there, fully alive, you have a chance to touch life in that moment, the wonders of life in that moment. Suppose you want to enjoy the beautiful sunrise. Breathing in and breathing out mindfully can help you to be truly there, because in the practice, we learn that life is available only in the present moment.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Vietnamese Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1997. He died last Saturday at the age of 95. On tomorrow's show, New Yorker staff writer Jane Mayer explores the conservative activism and influence of Jenny Thomas, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. In a new article, Mayer reports that Thomas, who said the country faces existential danger from the deep state and the fascist left, has ties to many groups with cases before the Supreme Court. I hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Saman, Teresa Madden, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our digital media producer is Molly C. V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.